looked at every past quiz for the last 20 years. How can it be any different? Okay, I'm going to... I'm going to start passing out the quizzes. As soon as you get your quiz, it'll be face down. Keep it face down and write your name on the back, okay? And then once everybody has a quiz, you can turn it over. When you get to the end of the row, just pass it on that side. Go to the front. There are lots of seats in the front. Should we make it back here? Okay, does everybody have a quiz? Okay, write your name on the back, turn it over, and you've got 30 minutes starting now. Write your name on the front as well. There are 3 pages in your quiz. Make sure you have 3 pages. have your attention for just a moment, please. On problem one, if you have Springer, the company's name is Springer, this is only for you if you have Springer. If you have a Cravat, you're okay. If you have Springer, there's been one line that somehow has disappeared, which is the cost of capital for the first 3 years is 12%. The cost of capital for the first 3 years is 12%. For years 1 through 3, the cost of capital is 12%.
5 minutes left. Thank you. 1 minute back. Time is up. Please hand your quizzes in towards the end of each row. Time is up.
Just put it on top of the stack right here. Yes, sir. Just empty. Please hand your quizzes in towards the end of each row. I'll pick it up. Well, send it again. I don't know why you didn't. No. Time is up. Any more quizzes out here?
These are excellent.
Okay. That's good. Take it up to the front. Quizzes, time is up.
First question, my return on capital was changing every year because there was a different reinvestment rate.
You could have done any one of them and I would give
you. Oh, so I did year one. Is that it?
Fine. That's year one was technically the right answer.
That really confused me though. And with regards to the last question, you had said that there was a 20% default. So the default would just be the amount of money that you would get minus the debt, right?
Yep. You can toss those away. Is that a quiz? Excuse me. Come on. Okay, folks, settle in. Okay. Okay. Hey guys.
Can you get that group back there? Tell them to just yell at them. Hey guys, sit down. Break it up. Okay. Sit down, please. It's too late. Oh, that's empty. Let's throw them away.
Okay, folks, so the usual rules apply. When the quizzes are ready, I'll let you know and then I'll set the solution. So I'll let you know when the quizzes are ready to be picked up. It'll be sooner than you think, so wait for the email. It won't be tonight. That's definitely off the cards. Sometime tomorrow, probably earlier rather than later. And I'll send out the solutions. So let's pick up where we left off on Wednesday. We were talking about price-earnings ratios and price-to-book. And I talked about playing Moneyball, okay? Moneyball, of course, is using data to draw conclusions, as opposed to what? As opposed to gut feeling, rules of thumb. So I'd like to start with that playing Moneyball with multiples and draw your attention to some very interesting statistical properties that multiples have that make them... Guys, stop talking about the quiz. It's over. It's a sunk cost. It's done. Right? Just let it go, right? Okay. Until you get it back, nothing you can do about it, so just let it go. So let's talk a little bit about those questions you need to ask about any multiple, price earnings, price to book, EV to EBITDA. So this was a statistics class, and I gave you a bunch of data, 50 data points. What's the first thing you're taught to do in a statistics class? What do? You crystallize them into an average and a standard deviation, right? And then if it's a good statistics class, you're asked to draw a histogram. You know what histograms are? You count the number of observations between 0 and 4, 4 to 8, you put in a distribution. Why do we do that? Why do we present data in distributions? What's a nice distribution to have for your data where you can do all kinds of neat stuff with the data? If it's normal. So the reason we put up histograms is to ask, can we get away using all that normal stuff plus or minus 2 standard deviations? Then you look for outliers, right? Basically, you say, what do I do about the outliers? And then you check to see if there's any bias in your data. So I'm going to use all of those things we've been taught in statistics on a multiple. At the start of every year, here's what I do. I compute the P/E ratio, price to book, EV to EBITDA, about 7 different, 8 different multiples for every company on the face of the earth. And then I draw a histogram, and this is a histogram of P/E ratios for U.S. companies at the start of 2017. Okay, so no rocket science here. I'm just counting the number of companies with P/E ratios 0 to 4, 4 to 8. So this is what the histogram looks like. So here's my first question. Does that look like a normal distribution to you? A multiple can never, ever be normally distributed. It's actually impossible, and here's why. In fact, you can tell me why. If you have a normal distribution, what are the outer edges of the distribution? What are the values range from? If it's a true normal distribution, it's got to go from minus infinity to plus infinity, right? What's the lowest value P/E ratio can take? 0. Which means you have the distribution floored at one side at 0. What's the highest value P/E ratio can take? It could be a really high number. I don't know about you, but I remember in my statistics class, these were called asymmetric or skewed distributions. And I never quite got why they had all these fancy names. If you have an asymmetric or a skewed distribution, I was told, never trust the average. What's wrong with using an average in a distribution like this one? All your outliers are big positive numbers. You have none on the other side. So when I compute an average, guess what? The average is going to get pulled out by the outliers. Here's the easiest way to see the distributional effects. I took all the U.S. companies and I computed simple statistics on current PE, trailing PE, forward PE. Remember we talked about current PE used last year's fiscal earnings, trailing PE used the last four quarters, forward PE used the next four quarters. I computed that for every company. So let's take current PE. There were 7,330 companies in my sample of U.S. companies. But I was able to get a PE for only 3,076. So here's what happened to the other 4,300 companies? Where did they go? Why did I have to take them out of the distribution? Is that right? Well, that would be a lot of outliers, right? 4,000 outliers. I've been going crazy with outliers if I did that. That would be a dangerous thing to do, actually, if I had that many outliers I was removing. Negative earnings. In fact, if you have a company with negative earnings per share, think of what happens to the PE ratio. It's not meaningful. I've lost 60% of my sample because they're money-losing companies. And that's not uncommon. In fact, every year that I've done this, and I've done this for 26 years, every year with PE ratios, you lose about 55 to 60% of the sample right off the top. We'll come back to that because that might create some bias in the remaining companies. The average PE ratio for a U.S. company was 114. That's kind of a scary number, 114. But before you get too freaked out, the reason it's so high is there's one company with a PE ratio of 134,400. One highly priced stock, right? It was actually trading at about $8 to $9, but because the earnings per share dropped to a fraction of a cent, the PE ratio exploded out. Do you see what's happening in my average? That outlier is pulling the number way out towards it. In fact, a more meaningful number, and this is what I was taught in my statistics class, if we have an asymmetric distribution, is I was told to use the median. The median PE ratio for a U.S. company is 21.57. If I asked you to describe in words to somebody who's not a statistics person what that 21.57 is, exactly how would you describe it? Do you want to try? How would I describe it to somebody? 21.57 median without using statistics.
The number that occurs the most.
Actually, that's a mode. Mode would be the number that occurs the most. The median is half of all companies with PE ratios in the U.S. have PE ratios less than that number. So it's actually the 50th percentile. Of companies that have PE ratios, you have to be very specific because remember, you lost 4,000. The true median for a U.S. company is actually zero. You see why? Because if I took the entire middle of the distribution, I counted all 7,330 companies, if more than half have PE ratios. So this is a nice trick question to ask. What's the median PE ratio for a U.S. company? It's zero. Why? Because there are no companies with no PE ratios essentially outnumber the ones that are. So among the companies that have PE ratios, the median is 21.57. How would I use this? You come to me with a stock with a PE ratio of 18 today. And you say, is that a high number? Is that a low number? I'm going to compare it to the median, not the average, not the mode. This is the number that tells me whether a PE ratio is a high number or a low number. Let me keep going. The 25th percentile is 14.33. What does that tell you? 25% of all companies with PE ratio in the U.S. have a PE ratio less than 14. So if your stock has a PE ratio of 11 or 12, right now, that's a cheap stock. I'm going to argue that if you have the entire distribution in front of you, you can create your own rules of thumb. You can tell me what's cheap or expensive on a pricing basis just looking at the distribution. One final question about the numbers. As you go through, as I go from current PE to trailing PE to forward PE, notice I start losing even more companies, especially with forward PE. So why do I lose another 550 companies when I go from current PE to forward PE? What is forward PE again? Somebody remind me. It's price today divided by expected earnings per share in the next four quarters. So where do I get that number, you think? For 7,330 companies. I'm not sitting there projecting earnings for each company. That would drive me crazy. So where do you think I go looking for those expected earnings per share numbers? Companies actually don't project their earnings for the most part for the next year. It's analysts who track companies who project the earnings. So what I'm looking for is an analyst estimate of earnings per share next year. So guess what those 550 companies that I lost were? They were companies that were not followed by analysts, and I threw them out of the sample. We create bias in the most subtle ways when we do pricing. Here's the first bias. When I threw out those money-losing companies from my sample, which is what I did when I threw out the 4,000 companies, I was introducing bias already, right? Because what kinds of companies lose money? They tend to be young companies, distressed companies, companies in trouble. I've taken them out of my sample. What's left then is a subset of healthier, larger companies. By going to forward PE, I made it an even smaller subset of companies that have analysts following them, which tend to be liquid companies that are held by institutional investors. That's the first step in the process of understanding what the numbers tell you about a multiple. So that's the first step. Let's keep going with what these numbers tell. I used to do this just for U.S. companies for a long time, so because that's what I had data for. So I did it in 92 and 93. But in the late 90s or even the early part of the last decade, when I went to Mumbai or Sao Paulo and I showed that distribution for U.S. stocks and I said, you know what? P/E ratios have this skewed distribution. A grizzled veteran, usually an analyst who's been around 30 years in that market, would put up his hand and say, it doesn't look like that in Brazil. So what doesn't look like that? So if you did a distribution like this of Brazilian P/E ratios, they wouldn't look like this. So how would you know? It's his gut feeling. And after about the fifth or sixth time of an analyst saying, just trust me, it doesn't look like this, I said, okay, let me go check out what the distributions look like globally. So starting about a decade ago, I started doing these distributions, not just for the U.S., but for every market. So this is actually what you saw for the U.S. And in every market, if you look, the peak is to the left, the tail is to the right. But there's an interesting way of comparing across stocks, which looks at the 25th percentile, the median, and the 75th percentile. Start of 2017, if you ask me what the most expensive market in the world is, I'm just going to compare the median PEs. The median PE for the U.S. is much higher than it is in the rest of the world. If you ask me what the cheapest market is at the start of 2017, it's Japan with a median PE of 13.86. On every single quartile and median, you see that Japanese stocks trade at lower multiples. The reason we look at data is to make sure that we're on the right track when we say a stock is cheap. What does this mean? If I come to you with a Japanese stock with a P/E ratio of 14, you compare it to the U.S. numbers, it's going to look cheap to you. But if you compare it to Japanese numbers, it's actually an expensive stock. It's more than the median. So it's very simple to do because the data is there. You have access to S&P Capital IQ. That's all I did was I collected the raw data, computed the multiples, and put up the distribution. Any questions on this? The basic statistics of what I'm trying to do here. Sometimes the differences can tell you something about differences across companies. January 2013, for instance, when I did this across markets. Notice the outlier? So if you look at, this is median price to book, market value of equity divided by book value of equity. You look across markets, the U.S. was the most expensive, trading at 1.54 times book value. Look at Japan. The median Japanese stock was trading at 2/3 of book value. It's clearly out of the norm, right? So essentially for the last 4 or 5 years, you look at Japanese stocks, they've essentially looked much, much cheaper than the rest of the market. Don't jump to the next conclusion, therefore I should buy these stocks. One of the things we're going to explore is why Japanese stocks might trade at lower multiples than the rest of the world. But at least looking at the data, you're getting a sense of that difference across the world. One final use for all these distributions is, you see rules of thumb. If you worked on Wall Street on an internship during the summer, you see these rules of thumb passing through. Stock that trades at less than 12 times earnings is cheap. A stock that trades at less than book value is cheap. An EV to EBITDA multiple less than 6 is cheap. And you wonder where these rules of thumb come from. I'm convinced it was some guy leaving his office in the late 70s in Wall Street on his way to a bar, yelling out of a window, saying, from this time on, 6 times EBITDA is cheap, and it gets passed on generation to generation. There's no good reason. One of the things I find useful is when somebody gives me a rule of thumb, they walk into my office and say, 6 times EBITDA is cheap, right? I say, okay, let me count some companies for you. And what I do actually is count the number of companies that traded less than 6 times EBITDA. It's a very quick, sobering device against using a rule of thumb. In fact, in June of 2010 or January 2010, if you told me 6 times EBITDA was cheap, I'd come back and say half of all U.S. companies traded at multiples of less than 6 times EBITDA. Wasn't cheap in January 2010. In 2017, it might be cheap unless you happen to be in Japan. Do you see where I'm going next? We should, I mean, I don't see why we still use these rules of thumb. It doesn't make any sense anymore. We have the actual numbers in front of us. Let's actually use the data we have rather than making up rules of thumb. So define, describe, and describe sounds fancy until you realize we are applying basic statistics to these numbers and trying to address the question of what's cheap, what's expensive. Which brings me to the third step in this process. Embedded in every multiple are all of the assumptions you had to make in your discounted cash flow valuation. Like what? You had to make assumptions about cash flows, assumptions about growth, assumptions about risk, right? They were in your DCF. Whether you like it or not, in every multiple, those assumptions are there. So when you use a multiple, one of the things, and this is actually the best way to think about multiples, is to back out from the multiple what those variables are that drive the multiple. So I'm going to take you through a process of deconstructing multiples. Or if I gave you a multiple, you can use that multiple to back into the variables that will determine that multiple. And it requires that you remember basic discounted cash flow valuation, because here's how it's going to work. If I come to you with an equity multiple, here's what I want you to go back to. The simplest equity valuation model you can think of, which to me is the dividend discount model, a stable growth dividend discount model. So there it is. Then I'm going to essentially do some algebra where I'm going to divide both sides of the multiple by some number, earnings, book value. And when I'm done, I'm going to end up with an equation in a discounted cash flow world for a PE ratio, an EV to EBITDA, an EV to free cash flow to the firm. By the time I'm done, I should be able to tell you what the variables are that determine PE, what the variables are that determine EV to invested capital, rather than just guessing. I know it sounds abstract. So let's take PE ratios, equity multiple, right? I'm going to start with the stable growth dividend discount model. That's actually called the Gordon growth model. It's a stable growth dividend discount model, expected dividends next year, divided by cost of equity minus the growth rate. So far, I haven't done any multiples, right? That's just a DDM. If I divide both sides of that equation by the earnings per share, here's what I get. I divide price by earnings per share, end up with a PE ratio. I divide dividends by earnings per share, I get the payout ratio. I can actually argue that the PE ratio for a stable dividend-paying firm is a function of three variables, the payout ratio, the cost of equity, and the expected growth rate. That's it. If you don't trust companies when they pay dividends, you say some companies hold back cash, you can replace dividends with free cash flow equity, and all that will happen, instead of using the actual payout ratio, you're going to replace it with a potential payout ratio. The PE ratio for a stable company that pays dividends is a function of the payout ratio, the cost of equity, and the growth rate. Holding all else constant, as my growth goes up, my PE ratio will go up. Holding all else constant, the higher my cost of equity, the lower my PE ratio because my discount rate is higher. And finally, holding all else constant, if I can afford to pay out more in dividends, that's like creating more quality growth, my PE ratio should increase. It's a very simple mechanism for deconstructing a multiple and backing out those variables. So let's kind of expand this equation, because it's clearly an equation that works if you have a stable growth firm. Let's suppose I came to you with a high growth firm, a Cisco. Cisco is not really that high growth. A Google, right? And I say, tell me what drives a PE ratio for a Facebook or Google and Apple. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to set up a high growth discounted cash flow model. Let's stay with the dividend discount model to keep things simple. This equation here looks like an elaborately complicated equation, but it's actually a present value equation. The value of a stock in a two-stage dividend discount model is the present value of the dividends during the high growth phase. That's the first part of the equation. And the second one is actually the terminal value. So it's what we normally do in a spreadsheet written as an equation. One of the questions you like to know the answer to when you look at a PE, when you look at a multiple is, as a variable changes, how will the PE ratio change? How will the price to book change? I'm going to argue by setting this up as an equation, I'm setting myself to be able to answer that question. Because here's what I did. I divide both sides of the equation by the earnings per share. I end up with a PE ratio for a high growth firm. And I'm going to list the three variables that determine the PE ratio for a high growth firm. You tell me whether they sound familiar. The price-earnings ratio for a high-growth firm is a function of its payout ratio, its cost of equity, and the expected growth rate. When I did my stable growth firm, what did I get? Payout ratio, cost of equity, and expected growth rate. All that's different about doing a high-growth firm is I have to estimate those three variables twice, and if I can estimate those two variables twice, I can tell you what the PE ratio should be for a 20% growth, a 50% growth, or an 80% growth rate firm. In fact, let's stay on that equation. I know math is way back in our past. Right? But But one of the questions I said we need to know the answer to, as growth changes, how will the PE change? I've given you the equation for PE there, right? You remember high school calculus? I know you don't, but no, remember that class that you kind of buried way back in? If this were a calculus class, and I gave you that equation for the PE ratio and asked you, how as growth changes, will the PE change? What am I asking you to do? What in calculus answers that question? Take the first differential of this equation, and you've got, I know that you've forgotten your calculus, but if you buy Mathematica, which you can buy at the student cost, you can actually enter the equation and do the first derivative, the second derivative. It's actually a very impressive way to start breaking equations down, because you can say, as risk changes, how will the PE change, as growth change? No, but it's very high tech for people who don't remember their calculus. So I'm going to give you a much simpler way of trying to answer this question. I'm going to do it by using a hypothetical company. So here's what my hypothetical company is going to look like. It's a high growth company. And here's what the next 5 years look like. They're going to grow 25% a year for the next 5 years while paying out 20% of their earnings as dividends. So they have a payout ratio of 20%, a growth rate of 25%. Let's keep the beta 1 in both the high growth and the stable growth period. So the beta stays the same. But at the end of 5 years, the company becomes a stable growth firm. Let's say the growth rate that the company will have in stable growth is 8%. Its payout ratio jumps now that its growth rate has dropped to 50%. Let's say the beta stays at 1. Say the risk-free rate is 6%. The risk premium is 5.5%. I've got a cost of equity of 11.5%. So here's what I have. During my high growth period, my growth rate is 25%, my payout ratio is 20%, my cost of equity is 11.5%. I plug those numbers in. In stable growth, my growth rate becomes 8%, my payout ratio becomes 50%, and my cost of equity stays at 11.5%. I plug them into that equation that you saw on this page, and what I get as my predicted PE ratio for this company is 28.75. You're saying, what does it even mean? If I'd used a two-stage dividend discount model to value the stock, that's what the value per share would have been. So essentially, this is just restating a dividend discount model in terms of a PE ratio. You say, why would I be willing to pay? Why would you be willing to pay a high PE ratio for this company? What is it that makes this company an attractive company? The fact that its growth rate is 25%, right? You're willing to pay a high PE because the growth rate is 25%. What's your nightmare scenario in buying a growth company? You pay 28.75 times earnings, you buy the company. And what could happen tomorrow? You could wake up and find out that there is no growth, right? Let's make that nightmare come true. Let's suppose you buy this company for 28.75 times earnings, and tomorrow you wake up and you discover that your actual expected growth rate could be lower than 25%, 20%, 15%, 10%. So basically, I've looked at... You could also wake up to a pleasant surprise, right? You could buy a company expecting 25% growth and wake up to 30, 35, 40. So all I've done in this table is held everything else constant and changed just my growth rate in that first five-year period. No surprises here. As my growth increases, my PE ratio increases. You think, why are there four columns here? I looked at four interest rate scenarios. From 4% T-bond rates to 10% T-bond rates, low to high. Under every scenario, the PE ratio increases as growth increases. But here's what the difference is. As my interest rates become higher and higher, my PE ratio becomes less and less sensitive to changes in my growth rate. In other words, when interest rates are high, I don't seem to care as much about growth when I set the PE ratio for a stock. Why is that? Why, when interest rates are high, does growth seem to matter less in my PE ratio? It's actually a very simple answer. Think about what the value of growth is, and the answer should be right there in front of you. What's the value of growth? It's all in the future, present value, right? As interest rates rise, what happens at present value? It goes down. You say, how much could it go down? Put yourself in Brazil in 1991. You know what interest rates were? 5,500%. Let me ask you a question. How much is growth worth when interest rates are 5,500%? Close to nothing. What if I surprise you and say my growth doubled? It's still nothing. As interest rates go up, I become less and less willing to pay for growth. So surprises about growth matter less to me at high interest rates as opposed to low interest rates. So what environment are we in right now in the U.S.? A high interest rate environment or a low interest rate environment? It's a low interest rate environment. Let's carry this to the next step. How do these surprises about growth manifest themselves? You're an investor, you buy a high growth stock. What is the mechanism by which you find out that growth is not going to be as high as you thought it was? What's usually the delivery mechanism for that news? How do you find that out? An earnings announcement, right? Basically, you hold the stock and you say, I expect the earnings to go up 50%, and the company comes out and says, you know what, we lost to zero. It's only 5%. It's a negative surprise, right? You know what this graph is telling you? When there is an earnings announcement surprise, the effect of that surprise will be much higher now because interest rates are low than they used to be 10 years ago, 20 years ago. The same surprise is going to have a much bigger impact on your stock price because the present value of growth is a much bigger part of your total value. Earnings surprises have become, you know, the effect on stock price have become larger over time. And people argue that it's because markets are less efficient. It's got little to do with market efficiency. It's got everything to do with the fact that our T-bond rate now is 2% as opposed to 4.5% 10 years ago and 6.5% 20 years ago and 10% 30 years ago. As interest rates change, the effect of earnings surprises is also going to change depending on the level of rates. So it's actually a very simple implication that comes from just playing with a hypothetical company. I did one more what if. I said, what if the company gets riskier? Same growth rate, whatever. And again, the answer is not surprising. As I keep the growth rate the same and I increase my beta, riskier stocks, you tend to pay a lower P ratio for the same growth rate. Why? Because that growth is worth less because the risk has gone up. So I'm going to do a what if here. Let's assume you're the CEO of a company. You're a very risky company. Your beta is 2. And your growth rate is, let's say, 20%. So you're a high-growth, high-risk company. And right now, you're way out at the end of the graph. And your price-earnings ratio is about 8. And you're very disappointed. So you come to me for some advice. You say, I want to increase my price-earnings ratio. What can I do? The first way you can increase your price-earnings ratio is by going for more growth, right? But if you go for more growth, you're stuck in this last section. There's not much room to run. What's the other way you can increase your price-earnings ratio instead of going for more growth? Go for less risk. And the payoff there is actually much greater than going for more growth. It's an insight that many growth companies don't seem to get. They get so focused on growth and more growth and still more growth that they forget that the risk variable might actually deliver a much bigger payoff. In fact, if you look at Amazon's history, that's the insight that Jeff Bezos had in 2000 that allowed Amazon to survive. He said, forget about growth. Let's survive. Let's make sure we get through this. Because if we don't do that, it doesn't matter how high growth is. It's a trade-off you have to think about when you think about P/E and growth. So let me summarize. When you look at a P/E ratio for a company, and I said this stock is cheap because it trades at 6x earnings, there are 3 questions you need to ask me to make sure the stock is cheap. So ask me the 3 questions. I've given you the incentives. What the 3 questions are. What's the first question you're going to ask me? I'm sorry? Earnings are good, but the current earnings have already built into PE. So remember, you're looking for a mismatch. So when I say the PE ratio is low, the first question you're going to ask me is, what's my growth rate, right? And if I say my growth rate is minus 5%, there's your answer for why. So now I've given you the template. So first question you're going to ask me is, what's the growth rate? What's the next question? Anna? What's the risk of the company? Because I might not even think in terms of, because remember, we're now in the pricing realm. We're no longer DCF people. So if you're talking to an analyst, you're going to say, how risky is this company? And most of the time, what's the answer you're going to get when the stock is trading at 6x earnings? It's a very risky stock. And the third question you should ask me, and this is related to the payout ratio, is how do you get a high payout ratio with a high growth rate? You have to have a high return on equity. So the third question you're going to ask me is, what's my return on equity? Most of the time, when you see a stock trade at a low PE, it deserves to trade at a low PE. It's trading at a low PE either because it's really low growth, or really high risk, or really terrible returns on equity. So I'm going to ask you a follow-up question. If you wanted a perfect cheap stock on a PE ratio basis, you want a stock with low PE. You want a stock with a low growth rate or a high growth rate? If you want something that's really cheap and you want to actually add it to your portfolio, you want low growth or high growth? You want high growth because you don't want anything that explains away the low PE. So you want low PE and high growth. So I've kind of given you the next step. I'm going to ask you, do you want low risk or high risk? What do you want? Well, you got a 50-50 shot at least. You want low risk, right? Because we say high risk, it explains. So remember, you don't want anything that explains away. You want low PE, you want high growth, you want low risk. Low return equity or high return equity? You want a high return equity. So this is what you're looking for. You want a low PE, you want high growth, you want low risk and a high return equity. You're saying, what chance do I have of finding something like that? No harm looking. That's why you screen for stocks. Go into the S&P Capital IQ, you have access to it. This is easy to do, right? You can screen for every stock with a PE ratio less than 10. You're going to find thousands of stocks. You say, what the hell am I going to do? Look for stocks then with a growth rate greater than 15%. Your sample will go from thousands of stocks to hundreds of stocks. Now you got something that's more. Then look, you choose whatever measure of risk you want. You want betas? Look for stocks with betas less than 1. Your hundreds will become maybe 80 stocks. Then ask, I want only stocks which make a return equity more than 25%. You might end up with like 25 stocks. Don't be crazy and just buy the stocks blindly. But this is how you can kind of zero in on stocks that are most likely to be misvalued. Yeah.
So you told us that the three critical factors in the P ratio
right. are... Go ahead. You don't have look back, so
okay,
growth,
risk,
And but the payout ratio is a derived... You see why? Because to have a high payout ratio for a given growth rate, what do I need? High return equity. So you can use payout ratio or return equity interchangeably. I prefer return equity simply because it's a more generic variable. Right?
Okay. So if we're looking for stocks, like screening for stocks where all three of those are good.
Yeah. But make sure you also screen for low PE, right? So there are four screens you need to run. You want low PE, high growth, low risk, and high return equity. Well, how you won't find out till you look, right? Maybe it is impossible, and after looking, you might find nothing. There are 7,330 stocks. You're hoping that one of them at least comes through. If nothing comes through, nothing's lost. It took you 3 minutes, run it on Capital IQ. But if something comes through, take a closer look. I can't guarantee you. You're right. It could be the market is efficient, that every high-growth stock trades a high PE ratio. But the essence of pricing is what? That you think markets make mistakes in pricing stocks relative to each other, and you're hoping to catch that with your screens. Right?
Okay. Say you have a stock that rated positively on all three factors.
See, but remember, positively is based on what you compare it to, because you said high growth.
High growth.
What did you use as your growth rate cutoff? Let's say you put in 25% and nothing came through. Mm-hmm. What are you going to do next? Try 15%. Do you see where I'm going? You can never get zero because you set the parameters that you use to define high growth and low risk. So if you get nothing with your first screens, maybe you're looking for the impossible. Maybe you're looking for stocks with a PE ratio less than 5, a growth rate greater than 100%, no risk, and a return equity of 50%. You're probably right. You will find nothing. But if you take a PE ratio less than 8, a growth rate higher than 20%, a beta less than 1, and a return equity greater than 15%, you're going to find some. So you might have to play with the screens. The first time you run a screen is just the starting point. Look to see how many you get. An S&P Capital IQ will actually tell you 7 stocks past the screen or 70 stocks past the screen. So you can actually change the screens until you get stocks coming through. But what you're trying to do is you're saying, these are the variables I want in my stock. And I'm going to try to find, as best as I can, companies that meet those criteria.
Okay, and if the three factors explain most of the variation?
It should explain all of the fundamental variation.
Okay.
You know what it doesn't explain? Craziness, momentum, mood. But if your job is to pick stocks based on the fundamentals, this is it. These are the three. There's nothing else because that's all is in the equation.
Okay.
That's so. Exactly. It's a pricing game. That's exactly right. Right. And what are you hoping for then? You're hoping that the mood shifts or the mood changes and you're going back to fundamentals. So you're still trusting markets to correct their mistakes, but you're playing the pricing game. Right. In fact, I'll tell you how I use it. Right. Let's say at the start of the year, you want to find 5 cheap stocks and you believe in discounted cash flow valuation. That's how you pick stocks. Do you see the challenge you face? There are 7,330 stocks. If you move alphabetically from A through Z, saying, I'm going to find 5 cheap stocks, you're never going to get there. There are too many stocks. So what you do is you use screens to kind of narrow down 50 stocks that are interesting based on the mismatch. And then you do your discounted cash flow valuation on those 50. It lets you narrow your focus Because otherwise you're distracted. You say, that looks cheap, that looks cheap. And the next thing you know, you have no idea what you're doing. So you get stuck. So basically, this is my way of kind of narrowing my focus, saying these are the stocks that I'm most likely to find something interesting. So I'm going to let you play the role of an analyst. So basically, this is going to be the start, and of course, we'll continue in the next session. I'm going to play the role of a really naive analyst. Now, I'm going to put out all these recommendations that are horribly wrong. And I think you already know enough about P/E ratios to catch me on my mistakes. So you ready? Let's try first. I'm an analyst who compares P/E ratios across emerging markets. So this is March of 2014, pre-Ukraine. This is before Russia wandered into Ukraine. So I want to make sure that you can't say, oh, it's the Ukraine crisis that created. So pre-Ukraine. I'm going to tell you Russian stocks look really cheap. And my only basis for that is Russian stocks trade at 4x earnings. That sounds interesting, right? 4x earnings. The U.S. is 21x earnings. So ask me the questions you're going to ask before you decide. So I put out a recommendation. Buy Russian stocks. They're cheap. They trade at 4x earnings. What's the growth? I have no idea. Russian companies are very opaque. I have no idea how fast they grew in the past. Already you can see one of the problems is if your earnings are very opaque, your financial statements are not full. And also, Russia, for better or worse, is very much tied to oil prices. Right? So even if I told you a historical growth rate, what else are you looking at? You're looking at oil prices and saying, so the growth is probably going to be pretty bad, not because of any political risk, but because of the fact that oil prices are low, and that's going to drag down a big chunk of earnings. So growth is probably going to be bad. What's the next question you're going to ask? What's the risk? You don't even have to ask. It's Russia. Right? So we can jump to the third question. What kind of return in equity do companies make? Again, let's say they make bad returns in equity. What's the problem you're going to face with Russian companies? Even if you know, usually with bad companies, bad returns in equity, you try to change the management of the company, right? Don't try that with Russian companies. Bad things can happen to you. Already you can see that markets that look cheap have good reasons for looking cheap. So sometimes it's just interesting. You can get this data pretty much anywhere across markets. Take a look at the cheapest market. The cheapest market in the world today is Venezuela. Would you really? If I told you can buy Venezuelan companies for 3x earnings, people are not exactly lining up saying, that's a bargain. It's not, because given the risk and the both political and economic risk in Venezuela, you'd be crazy even at 3x earnings to just jump in. So you can already see comparing P/E ratios across markets is going to be messy. Let me do one final example, just to kind of illustrate one of the ways you might be able to control across markets. This is way back in time, June of 2000. I pulled up the P/E ratios for a bunch of then emerging markets. So basically, you see the P/E ratio in the first in the second column. And if I picked just based on P/E ratio, the cheapest market in the world would have been Turkey, followed by Argentina, and then you'd have risen up the ranks. But I'm going to give you three pieces of information on these countries. So these are country numbers that might lead you to reassess. The first is I've given you the level of interest rates across the countries. Very different, obviously, higher in some countries than others. The second is I've given you the real growth in each of these countries. And some countries have high growth and others have low growth. And the third is I've given you a number that measures country risk. And the higher that number, the riskier a country. So again, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked you about an individual company. If you want to pick a cheap country, you want a low PE, right? So that's easy. You want low interest rates or high interest rates? You want low interest rates, because high interest rates can explain. So you want low PE, low interest rates. You want high growth or low growth? You're kind of getting it. It's high growth. And you want low risk or high risk? You want low risk. So basically, you're looking for a country with low PE, low interest rates. You can start eyeballing the data, but you're going to start to get really dizzy really fast. So here's how I pulled out my statistics book. And remember that multiple regression chapter, where basically I have a dependent variable and independent variables? I took the P/E ratios of my countries and ran a regression against interest rates, GDP growth, and country risk. And the coefficients actually are what I'd expect them to be. The higher the interest rate, the lower the P/E. The higher the growth rate, the higher the P/E. And the higher the country risk, the lower the P/E. So if I have this regression equation, how would I use it to find cheap and expensive countries? What do I need to do? Let's go back and look at Argentina. I have interest rates, GDP growth, and country risk for Argentina, right? If I plug those numbers into my regression equation, I'll get a predicted PE for Argentina, and that number works out to be 13.57. Given Argentina's high interest rates, real growth, and high country risk, the PE ratio should be 13.57. It's actually trading at 14 times earnings. That makes Argentina slightly overvalued, even though the PE ratio looks low, and I do that for every country. So next session when we start off, you're going to see me draw on multiple regressions, not in some elaborate sense, but as a way of controlling for differences across companies and countries.
Yeah. Quick question. Tesla just released a new report that they sold 6.5% more cars in the first quarter than the last year in the first quarter. 6.5% more. Yes. I know, but can I put that? How do I put that? Because the only thing I
what does it take to change the end game? Does it change a million cars if you do like 10 million cars?
No.
It just means that they might be because you need to actually have to do that. You have to do that.
It's freaking me out because they're trading at like 290 now.
They went up. They also went up like crazy.
Yeah, that's they're trading at like 290.
It's surprising. The people react. We talk about information.
Yeah.
Information. They're tested. So I think in an intrinsic value analysis,
okay.
You have to ask yourself: does this change my fundamental score? Does it mean they're going to sell? If there was something in the story that would lead you to think that they can sell 3 million cars rather than 1 million cars, that could change it.
Yeah.
So that's a question you want to ask yourself. Take a piece of the story. Does it change my story about revenue? Does it change my story about margins?
Okay.
Does it change my story about the risk of the company? And once you ask those questions, the answer is no, not really, no, not really, not really. The value hasn't changed.
Okay. Thank you.
I think I wanted to ask you, I didn't really understand like, how can it be possible to have low risk, high growth, like everything, isn't it a trade-off though? Isn't that the way finance goes?
You do price, you look for a cheap stock, you're looking for a cheap stock. So the question of what you should expect to see is what we're getting from that intrinsic view equation. What you actually see is what people are actually paying. So you took Tesla today and you can see what price he
was. So wouldn't everyone just invest in all these stocks which you like these
well you might have an